doesn't sound like we should say goodbye. This sounds like how we should say hello. But we're here to say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody. My name's Scott, and it's been a real thrill being here with you today. In this muggy Jersey City downtown studio, where we just heard from the Invaders. Spacing Out, name of the track, from a great collection on Sinecure called Enjoy the Experience, homemade records from 1958 to 1992. Eurythmics prior to that from In the Garden, the track Sing Sing. It was preceded by Salvia Plath and the track Salvia Plath. The CD is called The Bardo Story. It was preceded by Nymph, New Millennium Prayer, their new one on Northern Spy. We heard Beyond. Ghost Box Orchestra out of Boston, CD called Vanished. We heard Into the Light. For that, Strange Forces on the New Weird Australia label, self-titled CD from which we heard Liquid Sunlight. Early 80s music from Australia, New Zealand, Peter Jeffries. CD reissue, The Last Great Challenge in a Dull World. We heard Catapult. David Kenneth Nance. Great record on the awesome label Grapefruit. It's called Actor's Diary. We heard excerpt from An Actor's Diary. And we opened up the set with music from Johnny Cash's old stage manager, Chance. CD is called In Search. We heard High Test. That's everything we heard. I look forward to seeing you next week. There will be another installation of WFMU's Suicidal Summer with another staff cover of Institutionalized. God knows what else there'll be, but I'll be there. Hope you will, too. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WNYX Montgomery in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and worldwide online at WFMU.org. I'll see you next week.
Good evening. It's just after 6 o'clock here at WFMU, and you were listening to Too Much Information. My name is Benjamin Walker, and today on the program, we are talking about Hollywood and Hitler. That's the title of a new book by Thomas Doherty, who is our guest today for the whole hour. You know, the evil Nazi has been a staple villain for Hollywood films for decades now. Tarantino even trotted them back out a few years ago in 2009 for Inglourious Basterds. But you might be surprised to learn that it was not until 1939 when Hollywood releases its first full-throttle anti-Nazi production, Confessions of a Nazi Spy. Thomas Doherty's book starts out in 1933 and documents the story of how Hollywood gets there. So let's see if I have the technology working. Hey, Thomas, are you there? Hello, Thomas? Let's see. Hey, Thomas, are you there? Hello? Hello, Thomas, are you there? All right, let's have some technical difficulties here. One second. There now, right, Thomas? Are you there?
I am here.
That was all my fault.
Oh, well, that's always good to know.
It was completely 100% my fault. I apologize for that. Welcome to WFMU.
Happy to be here.
All right, so Thomas Doherty is the author of Hollywood and Hitler. Now, you point out time and time again in this wonderful book that in 1933, Hollywood was extremely cautious about mixing politics and the movies, mostly because it saw its audience as global and what might work out for the American customer might be offensive, say, to one in Germany. In fact, this is how you begin the story. Can you tell us about what happened in Germany in 1930 when the movie All Quiet on the Western Front opened up in Berlin?
Well, it's one of these perfect set pieces, is the kind of thing that you sort of would think like a dramatist would write. The famous anti-war film, All Quiet on the Western Front, from the most famous novel on the planet by the German author Erich Maria Remarque, an international bestseller and really the first true international blockbuster, is made into a movie that's quite faithful to the anti-war ethos of the original by Universal Pictures, directed by Lewis Milestone, and it's an international hit. It's basically, in 1930, the first must-see sound film of the new sound era.
And it's not just in America, right? Not just in America, all over the world?
Yeah, it's released all over the world. But in Germany, in December of 1930, it's released in Berlin. And because this is basically a pro-German story, and indeed, when you think of it, like 12 years before, the British and the French and the Americans are fighting the German, the bestial Hun. But by 1930, most of the world has learned that the great enemy in World War One was not the Germans, but war itself. And it's a film about the great war machine, and it's an anti-militarist film. And Carl Laemmle, Universal president and a founder of the company, was quite proud of this film, which was overseen by his son Carl Laemmle, Jr. And it's released in Germany in December of 1930. And this nascent political movement, the National Socialist, uses
the early days
as a way to cower the sort of the tottering Weimar Republic. And at the screening, the second night, led by Joseph Goebbels himself, a group of brown shirts infiltrate into the audience. They release white mice into the crowd, stink bombs. Disrupt the screening. They stand up and they yell "Judenfilm," Jewish film, and say that this film is a slur on the great soul of the German people. And Lemley and Universal are quite shocked by this because, of course, they see it as a film that's not anti-German in any means, but just anti-war. And the long and short of it is that the Weimar government capitulates to the Nazi demands and bans the film. After it had been cleared, it had gone through a quite extensive censorship process, both in America and in Germany, so to make sure that the film sort of met the basic standards of decency and sort of a political balance. But the Nazis don't see it that way. And it's really the kind of the first time, not only that does Nazism register on the radar back in Hollywood, but that the Nazis know that they can sort of cower the craven Weimar government with mob violence and street violence.
You know, this is, okay, the first time that this happens, and as, you know, we're going to hear throughout over the next 9 years, there's a lot of issues that Hollywood moguls are dealing with Germany, especially, you know, from to 36. But it seems to me that, like, from the get-go, there's sort of a disconnect here. It's, you know, as you said, the film is not anti-German, and yet the Nazis, you know, make this literal stink with stink bombs and outcries. But this kind of is a pattern that goes on. Then the demands, the requests are never really rational.
Oh, no. And the Nazis don't really care about the film itself so much as they're using it as a wedge issue to further their own power and to apply pressure to the Weimar government, which will then capitulate. And after that, of course, the Nazis know that mob violence is going to be one of the ways that they can gain power. And I think it's interesting that the first time this sort of registers, both in Berlin and in Hollywood, is around a movie, around All Quiet on the Western Front. And it's allowed the Nazis to kind of redefine the Great War as this stab-in-the-back scenario, and then also redefine Hollywood itself as sort of this Jewish agency that's promulgating anti-German ideology. Mm. And so they succeed in those two goals as early as 1930.
Yeah. You know, we hear a lot, especially right now, that the DVD market is dried up, that the foreign box office is absolutely crucial to Hollywood. I mean, we see this all the time with films. You know, they say Superman got rebooted because it just didn't make enough money overseas, actually, which is so bizarre. But can you talk about in the 30s what the foreign box, what Hollywood's relationship was with foreign customers?
Well, it actually is more crucial today than it was in the 1930s, although in the 30s it was very important, too. Anywhere from 35% to 40% of box office revenues were accrued from European, South American, and other markets. And Hollywood was always very conscious of marketing their films to a specific market. And in these days, it wasn't the day of the auteur and the autonomous artist where a film was thought of as this inviolable sacred object directed by Steven Spielberg or Martin Scorsese, that it was a product that Hollywood figured it can tailor to the individual needs, you know, cut off a little here, add a little there. And so if the film went to Britain and the British had certain objections, Hollywood would have no problem at all in slicing the film to British specifications. And of course, they started doing this in the 1930s to German specifications as well, most notably, of course, by eliminating any Jewish content from Hollywood films. That if your film has sort of discernibly Jewish content, like if it's the Coens and the Kellys go to Africa or something, there's no way it's going to get into Nazi Germany. And if it has recognizably Jewish directors or producers or actors, sometimes those credits would actually be excised from the print before it could play in Germany.
Yeah, you talk you paint a picture that's a little proactive, though. In other words, like, okay, so the Brits don't like this, so let's try to make a movie that doesn't do that. I mean, I would compare this to today in China. I read that Brad Pitt's new movie, the World War Z, apparently in the original cut, the zombie virus starts in China, but the China authorities were just not into that, and they're like, there's no way this movie is coming out unless that gets changed. So it got changed. So it was very, you know, much a sort of kowtowing to the demands of the Chinese. You know.
Oh, is that true? Because I saw the film in Bangkok, and as I recall, the zombie virus started in Taiwan, which would actually be interesting.
Oh, man, that's
I
amazing.
I saw it here, too, but I can't recall. recall where the virus started, but of course the thing about the plague is it always starts somewhere else.
Yes, of course.
Flu,
but
right?
I bring that comparison up because I'm wondering, like, what kinds of concessions were the Hollywood studios willing to make? Like, you mentioned, like, okay, you could take out some credits of some Jewish actors. That doesn't sound too difficult. But what kinds of demands were, you know, especially when the Nazis came to power, what were they? What kind of demands were they making of Hollywood?
Well, they did it in two ways. There was a German consul in Los Angeles, a guy named George Geisling, who was very alert to any potential anti-Nazi content in Hollywood films in the 1930s, and he knew exactly where to go if he got wind of a potentially troublesome project from his point of view, and that is to the Production Code Administration office run by this stern Irish Catholic named Joseph Ibreen. And the minute he'd read something in the trades, for example, about a potential film like Confessions of a Nazi Spy, which finally was released in 1939, he'd send a letter to Breen, warning him that if this film is made, you'll offend the German market. And the problem for the individual studios was that if, say, Warner Brothers made a film that the Nazis didn't like, the Germans would censor all films or forbid all films coming in to the German market, or they would threaten to do so.
That's what's happening now with China as well.
Even if the individual studio wanted to go ahead, the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, the kind of umbrella organization, had reason to discourage that because the other four major studios would have their films banned even though they hadn't been an offending studio. Mm-hmm. So there was a real financial disincentive to make explicitly anti-Nazi movies, and so we don't get one until 1939 from a major Hollywood studio, Warner Brothers.
Yeah. So when Hitler comes to power, hundreds of Jews and other enemies of Nazism are removed from the German film industry. And many of these directors and actors and actresses end up working in the U.S. Can you talk about what kind of stories they brought with them and what they had to, or lessons they had to offer about what Nazi plans were for films, both their own and those that they would let into Germany?
Well, of course, that's one of the great sort of unintended consequences of Nazism is when the Nazis go into the major studios, and especially UFO, which was really the crown jewel of the German studio system from the 1920s on. They go in immediately and purge the German film industry of some of its most creative talent, of course, the directors, producers, and actors and actresses of Jewish origin. And many of these people end up going to Hollywood as refugees, and especially as composers and cinematographers, I think. They bring a tone that's a kind of darker and off-kilter, and this is really going to blossom in the post-war era with the film noirs of the late 1940s, this sort of sense that you're always going to be pursued and that somebody's always going to come up to you and ask for your identity papers. And I find that's more in the tone than in the content of the Hollywood films, that there's just this sort of creepy feel to them. And even if at the end of a Hollywood film influenced by the refugees in the 30s or 40s, you have that kind of production code ending where, Fred McMurray is shot at the end and he's going to have, and justice will be done at the end of Double Indemnity. There's something about the tone of these films that's more, that's darker and more faded than you see in the main run of Westerns and musicals in Hollywood cinema.
Yeah.
I guess Billy Wilder is probably one of the most famous of these characters who comes into the American film industry and brings his own sort of edgy, off-kilter look.
Sure. I guess what I'm asking or what confuses me is that in the 30s itself, when some of these stars are showing up a little rattled, pursued. They were, they kind of had an inside view of what, I could imagine them sitting down with studio bosses kind of saying, like, these thugs, you can't work with them. It's only going to end badly. I mean, were the studio bosses wearing blinders? I mean, why wasn't there a sense of just like, all right, let's pack up shop?
Well, I think when we look back at the 30s, and this is one of the things I wanted to do in the book, Benjamin, is to sort of not have this ex post facto post-war vision on it, that to try to take the 30s as people saw them at the time, from 33 progressively into 1939. And you always have to remember that for the studio moguls and for you know, anybody working in Hollywood, the Germans they knew in the 1920s were competitors, to be sure, but they were basically sane, rational filmmakers. You know, that's who they were in the 1920s. Yeah. And then suddenly in 1933, they go pathological. The Germans go crazy with anti-Semitism and militarism. And it really takes a period of years for it to kind of dawn on people that they're serious about this, that this isn't just a passing spasm. And if you read some of the memos or the trade press accounts from the 33, 34, 35 especially, it's quite poignant to see these guys trying to grapple with the fact that, you know, what's going on in Germany? Are they really, like, serious about all this stuff? And they keep thinking that it's a spasm that's going to end, that
really?
That Hitler will moderate, that eventually the sane, rational Germans are going to sit down and start doing business with us.
Hmm.
And, of course, they never really do.
But isn't you tell a story about a Warner Brothers employee named Kaufman, a Jew who, you know, kind of gets physically rattled.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is a famous story that was really sort of hard to track down because Jack Warner sort of mistells it in his memoir published in the 1960s, the head of the Berlin office, Warner Brothers Berlin office in Germany in 1933, is actually physically attacked by brown shirts and roughed up. And of course, he leaves and Warner shuts down his office. And the fellow dies about 6 months later. And it's really not sure whether the beating had something to do with it or, you know, he had some long-term illness. But Jack Warner, to the end of his life, believed that, you know, this man was killed by brown shirt thugs in a back alley in Berlin, and Warner traces his own anti-Nazi fervor to that particular incident. And out of all the studios, Warner Brothers is the one that's really ahead of the curve in wearing its Jewishness and its anti-Nazi ideology on its sleeve, especially in private, that a lot of this couldn't get into the movies until around 37, 38, 39.
Yeah, yeah. So you're listening to Too Much Information. If you just tuned in, our guest today is Thomas Dougherty, who is the author of Hollywood and Hitler, 1933 to 1939. Now, we just talked a lot about how the studios were, the difficulties they faced from sort of German censors, German insane Nazi officials. But I want to talk about what was going on here in America. You just mentioned one of the censors here, the Breen office.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that there's just so many. We have the Breen office, foreign embassies, local censors, foreign agents like this guy, George Giesling, ensconced in Hollywood, studio bosses who want Hollywood to stay away from politics. But if there is a hierarchy, it seems it's safe to say that the Breen office was top of the hill.
Oh, yeah. This guy, Joseph Breen, probably had final cut over more movies than anybody in American history. He ran the Production Code Administration, which was Hollywood's self-censorship agency from 1934 is when it starts, and it officially goes out of business in 1967-68. Breen is in office for 20 years, basically, from 34 to 54, which coincides exactly with the, you know, the great golden age of Hollywood. And to get your film released in an American theater, you had to abide by the production code as read and interpreted by Joe Breen. And he would look at scripts before the film, before the camera started rolling. He would make notations, or people on his staff would. And then the staff would sit down and look at the final print. And then they would check it off. They would give it a production code seal. And if you are a fan of Turner Classic Movies or American Movie Classics, the next time you're watching a film from this era, somewhere on the title credits, usually in the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a little oval, and it says approved by the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America. It's actually a production code. It's a seal based on the Catholic imprimatur that the Vatican would give books that they thought were pure enough for good Catholics to read.
Wow.
And that was the model. And for 20 years, this model was a good business for everybody, but it meant that your film had to clear Joe Breen's office. And one of the commandments of the production code was that all nations and all races had to be treated fairly. And that came to be read basically is that you couldn't criticize any foreign government that was friendly to the United States.
Well,
Well, yeah, so it meant that anti-Nazi films were almost prescribed by the production code.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that for anyone who is, you know, loves old movies, and here in New York we have so many venues like Film Forum that screen, you know, pre-code films regularly, yeah. And it's so much fun. It seems that the code has always been about racy material, you know, it's been a crackdown on sexual jokes, yeah. or racy material. I mean, to you know, and for you in your book, you're talking mostly about political issues, which really seemed like not the priority for the code, or was it?
Well, it was one of the priorities, and indeed, the, you know, I love those pre-code films too, and like you say, they have this racy sexuality that you don't see after 1934. But the thing about the production code that was so effective and made the ideology of classical Hollywood so monolithic wasn't the easy stuff like. A flash of nudity or an obscene word or explicit violence, but the sense of what they called the moral universe of the production code, which was a deeply Roman Catholic vision that the guilty are punished, the virtuous are rewarded, and the authority of church and state is upheld. So it doesn't mean that all Hollywood movies have to end happily. It does mean all Hollywood movies have to end morally. So if you think of a film like Casablanca or It Happened, It's a Wonderful Life, those films actually have, you know, a really stern message, which is you have to do your duty, that your personal happiness isn't what's important in life. The problems of three little people in this world ain't worth a hill of beans, as Rick famously tells Ilsa at the end of Casablanca. And that's what the code was really about. That was sort of the superstructure of classical Hollywood cinema. And part of that was this sense of having a non-political world, or at least an overtly non-ideological world. And that was in tune with the Hollywood ethos. Sam Goldwyn famously said, if you want to send a message, use Western Union. And that Hollywood had kind of this inbred antipathy to message pictures, including anti-Nazi message pictures.
Sure, but this sense of like not offending a foreign government, I mean, that just seems so anti-American. I mean, I think you talk a lot about this time, about how there were so many inquiries into, you know, foreign influence in Hollywood, and, you know, it just seems like this guy you referenced early, George Giesling, you know, yeah. This German official ensconced in Hollywood. How the hell does he have this influence, and how does he use it?
Well, we're speaking from a 21st century perspective. In the 1930s, movies had absolutely no First Amendment rights. They didn't get First Amendment rights until 1952 by the Supreme Court in a case involving an Italian import called The Miracle. So anybody could censor a Hollywood film, whether it was the production code, the in-house agency. There were anywhere from 8 to 10 states that had censorship boards, municipalities. If the sheriff's wife didn't like a movie, you know, the sheriff could go down and close it down. I mean, it really was a different time in terms of what we think of as freedom of expression for, the great art of the cinema. So censorship was just a part of doing business for Hollywood, just the same way that you paid for the development of the prints at the lab. You sort of had to negotiate the censor hoops. And one of the reasons the production code was put into effect by Hollywood itself was to avoid all this multiplicity of different agencies, and you can go to one agency, Joe Breen, and when he cleared it, you were okay, and it's better than dealing with, you know, 100 different cities around America.
Yeah, you know, we're going to hear in a bit when we get to 39, but it, you know, there's a sense of the Warner Brothers linking together pro-Americanism and yeah. anti-Nazism. Is it just that this early there wasn't that link?
I think so. I think people from 33 to 37, plus the fact that it's not like America didn't have its own problems with something called the Great Depression, right? that there's this sense we don't know what the Nazis are yet. And to us that seems incredible because the Nazis are so vivid in our imagination. But that vividness comes from the Second World War. It comes from the Holocaust or the concentration camp footage from 1945 and from all the historical and filmic excavation that's been done since 1945 that's made the Nazis this universal emblem of evil. But in the 30s, I mean, there's a lot of competition for evil in the 1930s. I mean, the Japanese are killing more people in China than Hitler's killing in Germany in the 1930s. Stalin is certainly killing more people. And that vividness that is just so, you know, powerful in our minds.
Yeah.
In the 1930s, people didn't have that vivid sense quite yet.
No, you talk about this. You're just documenting some of the films, documentaries that have been made over the decades, you know, when new footage turns up.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some of these newsreels, this other Hollywood production. What did these look like in the 30s?
Benjamin, that's actually one of the more, I think, interesting parts of this story, because when we think of movies from the 30s or 40s, we tend to be thinking of the great feature films that are, you know, on cable all the time and that we see at the Film Forum and other places. And we see a lot of newsreel imagery from documentaries or on the History Channel or whatever. But I was surprised when I went back and sort of traced the history of the newsreels from 33 to 39 and tried to find out exactly what people saw then in the newsreels and how they responded to it, really how little footage of the Nazis and Hitler there was before the motion picture screen in the 1930s. And this stuff is very alive in our memory today, but most of the stuff was captured during World War II or discovered afterwards. The newsreels really had a difficult journalistic problem, and we always have to remember, of course, these are the days when not everybody had a camera in their smartphone, that Joseph Goebbels and the Reichsministry, the Ministry of Propaganda arm in charge of film, had total control over any footage that was shot in Germany.
Yeah,
a newsreel cameraman, you had to, you know, get your permission from the Nazis. They'd have to clear the footage, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So nothing came out of Germany that wasn't approved by the Nazis.
Yeah.
This put the newsreels in a real dilemma, which is either you show Nazi-approved footage or you ignore the, you know, most explosive story.
Sure.
On the European continent in the 1930s.
Sure. You use this great phrase. You call it Nazi-ganda.
Yeah, Nazi-ganda is what the trade papers dubbed this footage, which sometimes is shown kind of unfiltered, kind of as the cost of doing business for especially Fox Movie Tone, which had a newsreel branch in Germany and Paramount as well. And there were a few kind of iconic images that did get out with Nazi approval, or before the Nazis really sort of could, you know, clamp down on some of the newsreel footages. And I bet as I speak these newsreels, the images will flash in your mind, because they're shown recurrently, both in the 1930s and today, as kind of metaphors for the rise of Nazism. And one is on the April 1st, 1933 boycott of Jewish businesses, where you see these, you know, famous shots of brown shirts on trucks riding through Berlin, and the anti-Semitic signage on the shop windows, and then the May 1933 book burning, which is really in some ways this classic metonymy for what the Nazis are doing, which is, you know, incinerating knowledge, and it also foreshadows the conflagration to come, where you see the brown shirts tossing, you know, the classics of world literature to this great bonfire.
And someone got fired for that one. Someone got in trouble for letting that one out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Actually, Goebbels thought it was like big news. They had the cameras there. They you know, it was announced in advance, and they hadn't really gotten the sort of the media manipulation down, that they didn't know that this stuff wouldn't play in other places quite as well as it played in Germany. But those images are recurrent. But some of the other images that are in our minds, we weren't as widely seen. And images of Hitler, for example, weren't widely seen in the newsreels in the 1930s because exhibitors didn't want to disturb people during a, you know, nice night out for the evenings. And sometimes the image of Hitler on the newsreel screen would inspire fights in the audience, because the anti-Hitler people would yell, and then the pro-Hitler people would say, "Hi, Hitler," and then they get into a fight, and no exhibitor wants that. So there was really very sparse footage, relatively speaking, in the 1930s, until 38. 38 is really the kind of the pivot year where you start seeing America turn with attention to Nazi Germany.
But when does there's a newsreel that's very important in your story, that's called The March of Time.
Yeah,
Yeah. Is that 36?
Yeah, the March of Time was a screen magazine, a monthly, that is inaugurated in 1934. And where the newsreels tended to be very conservative and not really wanting to offend people, and they didn't have an aggressive sense of screen journalism at the beginning, the March of Time, which was a branch of Time magazine, had a much more aggressive ethos, and they weren't afraid to tackle controversy. So right from the beginning, they start covering Hitler, and then in January of 1938, they release a 20-minute screen magazine called Inside Nazi Germany, which is really one of the first unvarnished looks that Americans have at behind the scenes of Europe.
You quote a German official who let this happen as saying, "If Hitler sees this, I'll be ruined." But you know what? I have a clip from this. I want to play a few seconds of this. Let's see if this works.
In regimenting German thought, all radio programs emanate from the Department of Propaganda. Every newspaper prints only what the state wants its people to read. And any letter in the German mails is subject to censorship. For in Nazi Germany, every instrument that forms thought, communicates ideas, must be used to glorify the Nazi super state and its demigod, Adolf Hitler.
So that's ending, of course, with a postcard stand of Hitler postcards. But that's a clip from the March of Time inside Nazi Germany in 1936. So,
yeah, and the older of your listeners might recognize the narrator there as Westbrook Van Voorhees, who had this classic voice of God narration style, which most film buffs would know probably from the opening News on the March satire in Citizen Kane, which in the Mercury Players... sort of mimic that perfectly of that stentorian bombast. But to the credit of the March of Time, it's a really fascinating little clip, which I believe you can get on YouTube these days. And at the end of it, they basically predict the Second World War. They say that the history of military power in throughout history has always been it will eventually erupt into a war. And of course, this is January 38.
Yeah,
and, they're already predicting.
So today on Too Much Information, we're talking with Thomas Dougherty, who's the author of the book Hollywood and Hitler. We're just talking about the March of Time and the newsreels, which when it came out really upset the German authorities. But you document that it also angered some staunch anti-Nazis here in the U.S. as well. The Warner Brothers hated this film. Why?
That really surprised me, too, because if you look at it today, it seems just... profoundly anti-Nazi, unequivocally anti-Nazi, but the thinking was, and this is why always viewing these films through the eyes of the people who actually saw them is so instructive. The thinking at the time was, well, you're showing sort of a peaceful, prosperous Germany with, has these great athletic programs for German youth, and everything looks clean and prosperous. That from the vantage of the Great Depression, well, maybe you can make the civil rights trade-off. Mm-hmm. And so Warner Brothers actually thought that the visuals were more important than the narration, and that a good part of what people are seeing is a peaceful, prosperous Germany. Now, this is undercut totally by other images and by the narration, but that's what Warner Brothers and actually some other critics thought about this this screen magazine.
Yeah. Well, besides the critics, what about the other censors, from the Breen office down to the sheriff's wife and the local boards? Like, how did they take on
The Breen office, interestingly, did not censor newsreels or the March of Time. It didn't have authority over those. And so because it was sort of screen journalism, it kind of had a little more latitude. Now, it actually seldom used that greater freedom because, the ethos of the time was conservative and exhibitors didn't want controversy in their theaters. But the Breen office wasn't censoring this stuff. So when Inside Nazi Germany comes out in 1938, some censors try to go after it, but there was a kind of a sense in America that screen journalism should be protected with a little more rigor than Hollywood movies, which, of course, just had sex and violence in them. So the newsreels kind of could get away with that if they were gutsy enough, but they seldom were. They called it self-regulation or self-censorship.
Yeah. So as things got worse in Germany, what was happening in Hollywood? You talk about this amazing connection that when the German filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl comes to America, it's right at the moment of Kristallnacht.
Yeah. That's just another sort of amazing story is Riefenstahl, who in some ways, Frank Capra talks about being terrified when he saw Triumph of the Will because he realized, you know, this woman is really good with propaganda. And you could kind of write off most of the people working for Goebbels as hacks, but Leni Riefenstahl was a genius of the cinema, and anybody who looked at her movies sort of knew that. And she comes to America in 1938 to sell her epic film of the 1936 Berlin Olympics, Olympia.
You say she was carrying around the giant film rolls. Is that really true?
Yeah.
She was strong enough?
Anywhere from 3 to 3.5 hours long, depending upon what version she's got in the can at the time. And Riefenstahl is sort of this glamorous, attractive figure. And the press treats her like that initially. She's this splashy redhead, and of course, among all these, you know, overweight and sinister Nazis, she's good copy. And she comes to America in November 5th. She lands in New York, 1938. And the press is sort of treating her like this interesting celeb, a little kind of racy and edgy because she's allegedly got this romantic relationship with Hitler. And on November 9th and 10th, of course, that's the pogrom known as Kristallnacht breaks out in Germany. And they ask Riefenstahl about it, and she says, oh, the Nazis would never do any such thing. And you can just feel the press turn on her. You can sort of feel America with Kristallnacht turning away from any sense of neutrality with the Nazis. That's, of course, America does not want to enter the war. We're still isolationist in sentiment. But we are now, I think, firmly anti-Nazi. And Riefenstahl crosses the country as a pariah, and then she comes into Hollywood, where the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League is just waiting for her, and nobody's going to meet with this woman.
Yeah.
She's basically isolated for the few weeks that she spends in Germany. Nobody's going to see her. And she kind of gets ridden out of town on a rail. I think that's such an interesting moment. It's the moment where you can sort of see America turn in 38, because we've led up in 1938. You've had the Anschluss, the invasion of Austria in March. You've had the invasion of Czechoslovakia after the Munich Pact on September 30th. And then in November 38, you have Kristallnacht.
And
it's at that moment, too, that Warner Brothers announces that it's going to produce the first explicitly anti-Nazi film, Confessions of a Nazi Spy.
Yeah, but hold on. I've been dying to ask you this, though, because, you know, for your narrative, to this point, we've been talking about the power of images and the power of Hollywood. I learned that there is no footage of Kristallnacht. In fact, you say there was one amateur movie maker out there who was swiftly taken into custody and had his film confiscated. So I'm really curious, like, why, you know, you're really being strong there by saying this is the moment when things shift. And sure, I that sounds right. But what about the power of imagery from Kristallnacht?
Well, you're quite right. There I think there's some amateur footage of a synagogue burning, not in Berlin, in some other German town. It did not come alive in motion picture imagery. It came alive through the newspapers, which covered it like a blanket, and radio. Not live radio transmission. CBS wasn't able to get any broadcast out, nor NBC. But there were radio bulletins on this, and the president speaks out against it. Herbert Hoover speaks out against it. Dewey speaks out against it. Alf Landon, that all the major politicians speak out against it, and that's in the newsreels. But you're quite right, Benjamin. Right. There's no sort of dramatic images of Kristallnacht that stay alive in our minds.
So this is the moment, as you just said, the movie Confessions of a Nazi Spy gets announced. So I have a couple of clips on the WFMU TMI playlist for today. I put there's a clip from March of Time, and there's the trailer for the Life of Emile Zola film maybe we can talk about in a bit. But there's also, I have a clip from the Confessions of a Nazi Spy. Let's just play a tiny bit of this. Real quick.
The FBI has never done any counter-espionage work.
Well, somebody's got to do it, and I can't. The whole staff of the United States Military Intelligence Service in the New York area consists of myself and one assistant.
I don't suppose the government thinks the intelligence service is very necessary in peacetime.
Oh. Looks like it just shut off there. Anyways, that's on there, and the volume's a little low. But it seems that, you know, going very counter to that statement you made earlier about if you want to send a message, use Western Union.
Yeah, well, Warner's was sort of the only studio that sort of consistently disobeyed that periodically. So Warner Brothers made a film, Black Legion, in 1937, about domestic fascism, The Life of Emile Zolar, which is clearly an anti-Nazi allegory built around Zoller's heroic defense of Alfred Dreyfus, the unjustly accused military officer, you know, anti-Jewish officer is basically an anti-Semitic motive there by the French. And even films like Boys Town, which has this ecumenical group of boys, yeah, including a Jewish kid who, you know, are free to worship in Boys Town. Films. One of my favorites is The Adventures of Robin Hood, which I had seen before, but I never really looked at it with sort of this 1938 rise of Nazism eyes. And if you look at that film, it's not about the Sherwood Forest. It's really about democratic aspirations standing up to totalitarianism. It's quite explicit when you look at it through those eyes. And then Confessions of a Nazi Spy, which is really a shot across the bow.
Yeah, you quote Groucho Marx as calling the Warner Brothers being the only guys, the only studio with guts. What does this mean? Like, why did it take guts to make this movie?
Because it was the first time that a major studio defied the dominant ethos of the time, which is to lay low. Come on, politics are, you know, for the editorial page of your local paper. People go to the movies to be entertained. And that with what Warner's does is takes this stand they've basically been doing it since 1933 behind the scenes by donating money to anti-Nazi causes. But increasingly as the 1930s move on, they start wearing this anti-Nazism on their sleeve. And especially with a series of short films, which are not too well remembered now, but in 38, 39, they release 20-minute Technicolor shorts about the American pageant, about the Declaration of Independence, the Gettysburg Address, great patriotic themes. But all of them, I think, are really easily read as anti-Nazi allegories because they speak for religious and ethnic tolerance, democratic aspiration, the terror of tyranny. And, Warner's, as Groucho said, really is sort of the only studio with any guts. That's one of Groucho Marx's few recorded straight lines, I believe.
But, you know, when you say that you had to go back and sort of see Robin Hood differently, do you think people saw it this way at the time?
Maybe not Robin Hood, but something like Emile Zoller, certainly so. Something like Confessions of a Nazi Spy, obviously. Juarez, which is the Paul Muni film about the Mexican revolutionary. People read that clearly at the time. You have these Aryan colonialists who are oppressing the swarthy Mexicans. And, you know, the Mexicans rise up and rebel against their tyrannical overseers. And it's pretty connect the dots.
Sure. Can you quickly lay out the plot of that film for this
of Juarez?
Sorry. The Confessions of a Nazi Spy.
Confessions of a Nazi Spy is based on a true story of a group of the German spy network that the FBI basically stumbles upon in early 1938, because the Nazis had a fairly extensive network run not only from Germany, but with one of their fifth columns here, which is something called the German-American Bund. And, a fairly broad network designed to, gather intelligence in America and to spread Nazi propaganda. And it's a famous, and it was a court case in early 1938. Most of these spies escaped, and the case as a criminal matter really didn't go too far, but it really raised American awareness about Nazi aims and methods. And most importantly, from a production code administration point of view, they come to the conclusion that treating a foreign country fairly, as the code demanded, is not the same thing as treating a foreign country sympathetically. And if a studio could document what it was saying about a foreign country, as you could from the court records of this particular spy case, then the production code could have no objections under the production code to making a movie like Confessions of a Nazi Spy. And that kind of breaks the logjam. You know, once you can sort of make a film based on court records that's anti-Nazi, then the studios have permission from the production code to do it.
And
so from 39 on is when you start getting more and more explicitly anti-Nazi movies, even before America enters the war in 41.
Sure. But again, like that clip I tried to play, we have we have the quote, America might not be at war with the Nazis, but the Nazis are at war with us.
Right.
And there's this sense that this is a very patriotic, you know, pro-American film. And again, and you say this time and time again in your book, this seems to be the magic formula. Connecting anti-Nazi with pro-American is the swinging, you know, the home run.
Yeah, and speaking of home runs, that this is in 38-39, and America does not want to enter what's happening in Europe. But people now know on the horizon trouble is brewing, and you start getting this this resurgent wave of patriotism in America in 38 and 39, perhaps most famously in November of 1938, the month of Kristallnacht, when Kate Smith goes on the radio and premieres a song that becomes an immediate sensation called God Bless America, which later, of course, becomes the standard competition with the national anthem. And it's also when you start seeing the national anthem being played at movies and at sports events. So this resurgence in American patriotism in 38 and 39, I think, is clearly in direct response to, you know, what we see looming on the horizon, even though, you know, most Americans don't want to admit that, you know, another 25 years, you know, 20 years or so after the last war with the Germans, we're going to get into another war with the Germans.
So I kind of want to ask the big question about just the power of the movies then. I mean, you know, with all these sort of stumbling blocks from censors to, you know, cautious studio bosses to political issues. I mean, you know, you talk about Americans getting their news from the radio, from the newspapers. I mean, it's not like they'd never heard the word Hitler before.
Right.
It's not like you wouldn't hear about the Nazis. So I guess the thing is like, so we have this breakthrough in 1939. How much did it matter? Like, what influence did the movies have?
Well, I think what the movies do in 39, particularly during the Second World War, you know, is what they start is they link anti-Nazism to pro-Americanism. They really explain to America what's bad about the Nazis. You know, the religious and ethnic intolerance, the anti-democratic strain in it. And they explain that again and again. And basically, we start getting it during the Second World War with all those films that are about teamwork and tolerance. You know, the famous Warner Brothers platoon where there's, you know, the Irish guy from Boston, the Jewish guy from Brooklyn, the Italian kid from the North End, right? And they're all working together to make the B-17 fly. And it kind of looks a little corny to us now, but these messages really take hold. And after the Second World War is over, we're going to have this great explosion in civil rights. You know, first with films like Gentlemen's Agreement, and then later on you're going to have integrationist films, the late 40s and 50s. And basically it helps create this sense of diversity and multiculturalism that we all embrace today as a response to sort of the, you know, the monolithic racism of the Nazis and the Japanese during the Second World War. So I think the movies really do kind of have a pretty profound impact in transmitting that message in a way that's sort of dramatic and also emotionally persuasive. And that's what, you know, that's what Hollywood propaganda is at its very best, and why it's so much better than Nazi propaganda or Soviet propaganda, right? It doesn't have a guy screaming at you from the screen, but it has you know, Rick and Ilsa on the tarmac at Casablanca.
It's
just much more emotive.
You know, and we brought up China a few times now, and the other movie I would bring up would be Red Dawn, the remake.
Yeah.
So the remake, which was made a few years ago, of course, was the Chinese invading America. And the Chinese, echoing what you've just told us, basically said, absolutely not. But not only is this movie not coming out in China, but for Fox Studios, which owned it, if this movie comes out, I'm not sure how many Fox films are going to be coming out in China. And you know what? They digitally went back and redid the movie and turned the Chinese into the North Koreans.
Well, that's because the North Korean market is negligible, right? speaking of Casablanca, we're all shocked that business is going on here in Hollywood. You're right, and it's the exact same thing happened in the 1930s. I know overseas, Captain America was released as the first Avenger. You know, so So, this is always...
of course, and we're not at war with China, but I'm just very curious about what, you know, talking about the power of movies, like what sort of similarities or what lessons we have, you know, just sort of watching this. Because, yes, they're not roughing up American employees in Beijing.
Well, I think either as a businessman or sort of a moral filmmaker, is that at some point you would hope that you would have the foresight and the morality to say stop. And one of the things when I was going through this book, I was always sort of, it's really easy to look back and, you know, from the perspective of 80 years and to say to Jack Warner or Louis B. Mayer that you should have, like, closed up shop immediately and had nothing to do with these people from the get-go. But in 33, 34, 35, especially, it's just not so clear. Like, you know, are you going to, like, close down your multimillion-dollar business in Germany because these guys seem a little eccentric at the moment? You know, I like to think I would have been as moral as Jack Warner and not as immoral as Louis B. Mayer, who MGM basically stays until the guns start firing in September of 1939. But, you know, I'm not so sure. Like, you'd like to think you were always going to be farsighted and behave morally.
But, sure.
At the time, it's not as clear. And some people do, like Jack Warner and Carl Laemmle, I think, are real heroes of this story. Some other producers, maybe not so much.
Yeah, you know, I can't thank you enough for sticking with us the whole hour. Thomas Doherty is the author of Hollywood and Hitler, a new book from Columbia University Press. Out now. So thanks again for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. So thanks again. And let's see, we're almost out of time here. But I do recommend the book, dear listener. Actually found I couldn't put it down. All right, well, I want to thank Andrea Salenzi for helping me through the technical difficulties of the evening. And once again, to Thomas Doherty for sticking with us the whole hour. Stay tuned for Nardwar, who is up next.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WNYX Montgomery, online at WFMU.org, and in Rockland County at 91.9 FM. Coming up next, Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
Thomas.
I won't be bad like my mama never thought I'd be. Bad like you never thought you'd ever see me. Bad, oh please just be, oh please, oh please, oh please. Oh! Oh! Woo! Oh! I won't be bad like my mama never thought I'd be. Like you never thought you'd ever see me. Bad, oh please just be, oh please, oh please, oh please. My mama never thought I'd be. But you never thought you'd ever see me. Bad, oh please just be, oh please, oh please, oh please. Oh, oh, oh. Woo. I wanna eat as many of the apples. I wanna know and then forget everything. I wanna be like a pile of pebbles, skipping over and into a pond. And ain't nothing gotta stop me.
Listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette radio show. You just heard right there from Israel, Danny's Box O' Surprises with Bad. Today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette radio show, an interview with, from Seattle, Washington, Big Eyes. Coming up right now to prepare you for an interview with Big Eyes, gonna play a bunch of tunes. Gonna begin with a band from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, The Shivers, and their song Teen Line. All on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette radio show on WFMU. Oh yeah, here's The Shivers.